This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai today. On today's roundtable, more reaction to the president's State of the Union address. Plus, a BBC poll says the world's image of the United States has gone from bad to worse. And financing a presidential campaign. We'll talk about why it will be different in 08. Joining us on today's panel are E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, how are you, Tony?
Listen, we heard Ron Christie and Melissa Lacewell break down the president's State of the Union. And at the very end of that conversation, we began to talk about the Democratic response, and some suggesting that it was maybe heavy-handed, maybe bold, maybe a combination of the two. Before I get you to sort of weigh in on how the Democrats responded to what the president said, I have one more clip from Senator Jim Webb of Virginia. Here it is.
Some say that things have never been better. The stock market is at an all-time high, and so are corporate profits. But these benefits are not being fairly shared. When I graduated from college, the average corporate CEO made 20 times what the average worker did. Today, it's nearly 400 times. In other words, it takes the average worker more than a year to make the money that his or her boss makes in one day.
All right, so Jeff, what do you say about the Democratic response to the president's speech?
Well, I think that Webb made quite a strong response, and it was decidedly so. It was carefully chosen to come directly from him for a lot of reasons. Not only is he credible in the eyes of the American public, but he is capable of delivering a strong message like that that would be well received. I think the Democrats are sending a message here, and that is that we are a strong party. We are the party that the American public has elected to now lead the nation, and we're going to do that. And, Mr. President, if you want to roll along with us, then we'll count you as one of our ranks. But if you don't, then we will definitely snatch the reins and lead us into a new era of success. Now, whether or not that's a psychological advantage, whether or not it's going to be that simplistic in terms of making things happen, that can be debated. But I think that part of the energy around the State of the Union is very, very psychological in terms of the images that the people get. It's why the president delivers his message, whether it's full of content or not. That can be debated, but he delivers it in a strong way. It's why people use things like body language to say things or not say things. It becomes a standing ovation fest from different parties. So I think that psychologically, it made a statement on behalf of the Democratic Party that we are going to now snatch the reins of leadership and push this thing forward.
But E.R., did it sound to you as if there was a spirit of bipartisanship offered by the Democrats?
Yes, I think so. But it has to be seen as partisanship doesn't mean that everybody agrees on everything. As Senator Webb said, and I'll quote, if we're putting all this money into Iraq and ignoring New Orleans, then we're doing something wrong.
E.R., I hate to interrupt you, but your line is, we're going to see if we can work on your line to clear it up a little bit because we're having a hard time following you with what you're saying. So don't go anywhere. We're going to work on that, and I'll come back to you. John McWhorter, in the meantime, same question to you. The issue of bipartisanship, does it seem as if the Democrats are reaching out to the president, or are they basically saying, look, our way or the highway?
Well, what I detect is an awful lot of anti-Bush and anti-Republican sentiment, and I believe that that in many cases, if not most cases at this point, is perfectly appropriate. But what we see in the Democrats' responses last night and in general is an identity crisis in that party where there is a certain recreational thrill in being the party of not them, or particularly these days, not him. But then there's a problem in terms of coming up with what exactly, in a proactive sense, they stand for and what they want to do. And so it's one thing to congratulate Nancy Pelosi and Jim Webb and all of the other bright lights for all of their argumentative statements and catchy turns of phrase and haircuts and history, etc., etc. But if what really happens is that in a couple of months we find that they've basically gone along with the Republicans about halfway plus and everything that they wanted to do, then I'm less impressed. And so we have to separate the performance performance aspect of this from the active aspect of this. And I don't think we've really seen that yet.
I think that's an interesting point, because really last night stood largely on ceremony, didn't it?
Yep. It was all great theater. I love watching the State of the Union address just because of all of these protocols. But what's really going to happen after we're finished talking about it? And I think at this point, we haven't the slightest idea.
I think you're absolutely right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was also, I was going to say, I think it's also interesting that just to add to the theatrics of it, President Bush actually went there last night. He pulled out Dikembe Mutombo.
Yes, he pulled out
Wesley Autry, whose daughter, I think, was echoing the sentiment of most of America. She was asleep next to him when everything was going on. And Wesley was so New York. He had peace signs and everything up. And I love it. He needs to write a book and go out on the speaking circuit. But I think that, as we said, it's largely ceremonial on all points. And I think that if people, the American people, all of us, I think, really want to hear not just the rhetoric, but exactly what kind of proposals do we have for cutting out 20% of the gas use for the next 10 years? What kind of proposals do you have to win this war? It seems like I heard a call for a mercenary organization being created, when you're going to create citizens that could be armed, that could be hired to be sent over to fight a war. That kind of scared me. So I'd like to hear more about the details.
I think we have ER back. And before we go on to another topic, I want to give her an opportunity to sort of chime in on this. ER, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, you sound much better.
Yeah,
you sound much better. All right, so make your point.
No, I was saying on Senator Webb's response that I thought it was on target. I was particularly impressed that he connected the dots between the money we're spending in Iraq and the money we're not spending in New Orleans and the rest of the Gulf Coast. And it sounded to me a bit like what Martin Luther King Jr. did in the last year of his life, in connecting the money we were spending in Vietnam to the lack of money and vision we had for the urban areas of this country.
All right, if you're just joining us, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai, who's on vacation. Joining me on today's roundtable are E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. We're also joined by John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and also Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. We've been talking about the president's speech, but let's move on to another topic for today, and that's this. A new poll by the BBC says the United States' image took a hard hit last year, rising to 52% for those who see our global influence negatively. The sample came from 25 countries. Issues like the war in Iraq, prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, these are among the reasons given for this deepening negative slide. So how might a change in war strategy, I'm going to come back to you, ER, how might a change in war strategy change that global perception, and how long would it take to turn it around, or can it be turned around?
Well, first of all, we're not quite sure what the change in strategy is. It involves sending more troops in, and we just saw that on Monday, I believe it was, 88 Iraqis were blown up in a marketplace in Baghdad. Hundreds of others were wounded. We're sending more troops into that. I don't see much of the allies joining with us in sending in more troops. So the strategy part is the first question to ask. But it should not be so surprising that the rest of the world has these negative views, because Iraq is such a monstrous issue. And no one knows how to extricate ourselves from this in a way that makes the U.S. look okay, and in a way that maybe helps Iraq to get its act together.
Well, John McWhorter, how concerned should we as the United States even be about our image globally? And to what extent should we shape our policies with that in mind?
Well, that's a hard question, Tony. As far as I'm concerned, obviously, optimally, we want to stand well in the world's opinion so that if we need to do something, we can bring allies in to do it with us. And that means not only things involving guns, but maybe things involving global warming or talk about the immigration debate. But then on the other hand, I don't know. There's a certain distrust that I have about human nature when it comes to this kind of thing. And I know that in Europe, for example, I have two jobs. I do this, and then I'm also a linguist, and the linguist stuff has nothing to do with race. And I often go to Europe to conferences. Over the past few years, I've noticed that whenever I go to one of those conferences, you know, after a couple of glasses of wine, I have to start playing the American. They're not thinking of me so much as black as the American, mm-hmm. and my president is George Bush. And the conversations have gotten worse and worse, despite the fact that politically I am very much a centrist. There's this absolute hatred of everything the man does, everything that America has stood for over about the past 10 years. And this is the crucial part of it. Sometimes it seems to me that it's kind of like what I sense in the Democrats here. There's a joy in hating President Bush that goes beyond any kind of empirical argument. I have heard 13-year-olds in Europe say very anti-American things before Iraq and before Afghanistan just because they like railing their fists at the big monster. And so to an extent, I'm not sure how much we could do about anti-American sentiment at this point. It's not a surprise. It's only going to get worse given what's going on in Iraq. And, you know, Kyoto comes up every time you talk to somebody mm-hmm. from outside of this country. I don't know if we can do anything about it at this point. And sometimes it's so divorced from actual action that sometimes I think we are better going it alone. What we do alone, that's a different matter. But I'm not sure that I care as much about it as I suppose I'm supposed to.
Well, Jeff, you know, John's point is really interesting in terms of the president, George Bush, being a lightning rod for the anti-Americanism that's being expressed around the country, I mean around the world. So would you say, Jeff, that when the president, this president, you know, leaves office in a couple of years, that that opens the door for a new look at America?
I think it definitely opens the door. Now, it depends on who wins and who
Mr.
ends
Obama
up being in that seat. But, oh, yeah, well, exactly. It might give us a better global presence. But I think it definitely opens the door for a new way of looking at America. But I think, as John said, we've seen this anti-American sentiment a lot over the last decade. I know I got to travel to the Middle East about 15 years ago, and it was very much there too, but not as strong. It's increasingly worse. Almost 3 in 4 people have disapproved worldwide of the U.S. policy in Iraq, and 2/3 disapproved of the United States and the way they handled everything in Guantanamo Bay, simply because of the international implications. When you mention how does the U.S., when we talk about capital worldwide, do you need people? Some people say, well, people are, to use a hip-hop term, player hating on the U.S. They want what we have, so forget them. Don't hate, congratulate. And that works well if you don't need the rest of the world at any other time. But if you're going to need allies, if you're going to need people to come together globally to help solve global problems, then you have to be concerned about your global image. And I think the first thing we have to do is to pick an enemy that people can see. Right now, last night we talked about winning the war on terror. But how do you win the war on terror? Is some united terrorist society going to submit a surrender notice eventually via telegram or the internet? It's very nebulous. So until we define an enemy and then quickly end this, I think we're going to be going through a quagmire for some time to come.
One of the points that you raised was who would be the next president, and that leads me right into our third topic, our last one for the day. New York Senator Hillary Clinton will not accept public campaign financing for her run for president. I am not suggesting that she is going to be the next president. Let's just get clear about that. What's new is that she is the first to decline public financing for both the primary and the general election. Some are already calling it a very smart move because it frees her to raise as much money as she can without restriction. Now, Senator Clinton's decision is expected to influence how other presidential hopefuls raise money, although she is the first to commit to this strategy publicly. Kind of briefly, the question is, can you run a winning campaign without with public fund limitations? Let me make sure I'm clear on that. Can you run a winning campaign with public fund limitations?
Limitations.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem that one can. If you're talking about needing $500 million to be elected, then you cannot go through the public funding system. It seems to me not so scary that she's taking this route, and that will obviously lead other candidates to do the same to try to catch up to her, because there's so many more watchdog entities out there these days, whether you're talking about people who are blogging, as I have begun to do in the last week, or you're talking about various foundations that are set up to look into funding sources. So I think because this whole public election funds idea came about because of the crisis of Watergate, I think we've moved beyond that, and I'm pretty confident that we're not going to be in trouble if the candidates for the president don't go through this system. I would differ if we're talking about city council races and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Jan, we've got about a minute or so left. I'm going to come to you because I'd like to know, who do you think is best suited among these four presidential candidates, Clinton, Obama, McCain, and Giuliani, with regard to campaigning for dollars privately?
Well, as far as I see it, Obama is extremely promising. I'm a little perplexed at all of the journalistic prattle about, you know, who's spending more money and polls done 10 minutes ago, etc. Obama has a massive charm, a massive charisma that Hillary Clinton has never had. And it seems to me that he could almost get away with just using the public system because, you know, we've got the internet and he's got his just himness. I think that white America is in love with him for reasons that are both good and bad. I don't think he's going to have any trouble with black America. And so we can talk about what Hillary Clinton is doing, but I think we really need to be thinking about our great black hope and the kind of power that somebody like that can have above and beyond the mundane issues of how many millions he spends on his campaign stops.
Jeff Obafemi-Karp, gotta say I'm sorry because we have run out of time. I knew you had something really important to say on this subject. We'll have to get
we'll
to
get
you the
next
time.
E.R.
Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication, joined us by phone. John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy at our New York Bureau. And Jeff Obafemi-Karp, host of the radio show Freestyle in Nashville, Tennessee at Spotland Productions. Everybody, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tony.